You're listening to Panel Borders, which is the extended podcast version of Resonance FM's weekly show about the world of comics. I'm Alex Fitch, and to conclude Children's Comics Month on the show, I'm talking to writer and artist Jill Thompson about her comics, which include the graphic novellas for children Magic Trixie and Scary Godmother, and we're also talking about her career so far, which includes stints on Wonder Woman and Neil Gaiman's Sandman. First, here's a word from our sponsors.
Resonance FM is London's only non-profit community radio art station, who need your donations to help keep the station and podcasts on air. All the program makers and all the engineers all work for free to bring you shows as diverse as The Bike Show, The Free University of the Airways, Hooting Yard, Speakers Resonance Corner. FM accepts donations in the form of checks, credit and debit cards, bank transfers, PayPal and cash. Go to www.resonancefm.com for more details. We also accept hobnobs and teabags. Your donation means our continued existence.
I'm talking to author and illustrator Jill Thompson. This is your new book, I believe, an illustration from Magic Trixie.
There are 93-page graphic novels for all ages. Mm. They're given an age specification by HarperCollins, but like Scary Godmother, I do something that amuses myself first, and I want to make sure it's extremely suitable for anyone much younger than me. Mm. So, you know, I say it's from 3 until 80, depending on your sense of humor and how well you can read. And I made sure there's a lot of silent storytelling parts, so little kids will be able to understand what's happening by the pictures. Mm. I made sure there wasn't a lot of superfluous dialogue.
Okay. Well, because, I mean, that seems to be a dying art in both comics and film, telling stories visually, which is, you know, bizarre because both mediums are designed, you know, primarily for sequential images that in their juxtaposition they tell a story, and the dialogue in a way should be secondary because it's primarily a visual medium.
I don't feel that the word balloons should be describing what's going on. I really think, you know, the word balloon itself, the dialogue that's inside it, should convey a dialect, or it should be, you know, I mean, you can have a voiceover in a film the same way a caption box or certain word balloons are placed to send the reader's brain and eyes in a different direction, you know? I mean, that's really effectively using that, but I'm pretty basic in my storytelling. I love for people to be able to look at the pictures and tell what's going on without having to read what it's all about. And I hate a jillion word balloons, blah, 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 pasted all over the art that I really worked hard to make sure, you know, was drawn correctly, or a nice mood was created, or things were lovingly detailed back and forth so you can, you know, see background details and or certain kind of lighting. And then suddenly, comes back to you and all that's covered. So, I mean, I think, you know, it's very important for a letterer in comics to take not into account not only the flow of the page, but the pacing of the page. I mean, it can be very, I mean, it's the way the word balloons are placed can heighten the drama, can draw much more emotion out of a scene, the shape of the word balloon and the type of lettering that's inside of it. I feel like I learned from the best when it comes to lettering. Craig Russell told me how he approaches using lettering as another character on the page. And when he told me that, when I was in my 20s, I've just kind of latched onto that. And I'm a huge proponent of it. And I probably drive letterers crazy when I'm using them, because I do tend to letter my own work now. But on Magic Trixie, I hired a letterer named Jason Arthur, who's a really wonderful guy. Not only because he changed my handwriting into a font that he can use to letter, but he has been sweet and patient with all of my, you got to move this, you got to move this, it should be over there. This is all the negative space. I left this here, and I know you can't read my mind, and I don't want to lay everything out for you and then have you, you know, just kind of be my hands, because that would make me angry. But this is kind of how I expect to see something. So I've had him go back and do a bunch of changes. He still wants to work with me, so I suppose I haven't been too much of a bitch about it.
Well, it's interesting to see artists who letter their own work and then letterers who are very much sort of professional graphic designers like Todd Klein. Because I think looking at the lettering that you've done for your own work, say people like Craig Russell, Eddie Campbell, there's very much the personality of the artist in the lettering as much as there is in the art. I mean, do you see that as sort of like a second voice that you're adding to the narrative?
I think it's the sound of the character's voice. I mean, look what Todd did when he created, and I've heard him say more than once, if I would have known these guys were going to appear more than once, I would have never made a different font for each one of the Endless. I'm sure, especially Delirium, because all of that had to, when I was working on the book, he was hand lettering it. I was like, oh, he was earning his money.
Poor guy.
Earning his many Eisner Awards. But I do believe it. Mine is a very organic style. Mm. I don't think that my kind of crappy handwriting, which looks really good with Scary Godmother and Magic Trixie, would work, or even on the dog and cat stories that I do with Evan Dorkin. We're working on 4-issue miniseries of that.
Because I just read the one that's in the Dark Horse Book of Hauntings. Is that sort of then like
that's
a prologue?
That's the first one.
Ah, brilliant.
There are 4 of those books. Mm. So there are 4 stories there. And then we're going to take those characters and do, you know, regular comic episodes with them.
Like a cross between Lady and the Tramp and Poltergeist.
Ooh, that's a good way of thinking about it. In fact, I was going to, I'm going to go get Lady and the Tramp just so I can rewatch dogs running around. And, I mean, I've got a lot of video of dog shows and things like that. But, you know, those are animated dogs that talk to each other. And I do think one of the best songs ever is when that, he's a tramp.
Mm-hmm. Peggy Lee.
Singing that kind of scruffy dog eating spaghetti. Singing a love song to Tramp. But those stories, my lettering works well for them. I like to make the word balloon, you know, big, and I call it, Jason knows it, is the shouty word balloon. And then I have the pointy shouty word balloon, and then what would be Bugaboo's word balloon in Scary Godmother with kind of like a rough edge around it, because to me that's meant to convey a deep, gravelly, rough voice. For Bugaboo, it's like a big kind of Chicago working class guy voice. But with the dogs, it's more of a burst of shouting. And then for me, the letters can be big and disorganized or kind of scratchy to convey more of a shout. And then I really like for whispering to have a really big word balloon with teeny tiny, barely visible words. And if the bottom of the word balloon is dripping, it's full of sadness. Or it can be really rectangular and be icy cold. You can make the words convey the tone or the emotion of the character or the type of character. You know, if it's kind of science fiction-y, that of course the reader gets to fill in how they interpret that. But I think the word balloon gives them really good direction to move, and it helps define the personality of the characters. And then, you know, there are other instances where regular word balloons do the job just fine.
Sort of discounting what I said initially, I read that the way that you sort of found a path to regular comics illustration was that you're a big fan of Sandman, and you sent Neil Gaiman an illustration of Death, and he was so impressed that he hired you for the comic. Presumably it's a little bit more complicated than that.
That is only has a grain of truth in it.
Okay, so much for Wikipedia.
Oh, that entry is very confusing. And I've had friends who've said, you know, they've had entries about themselves. They go back to correct things because they are the human being about which this entry has been designed. And it's changed to the more popular notion or whatever else. And it's like, oh, that'd be frustrating. I always send people to my blog when it's like, if you want to hear anything and in my voice and something that's only slightly exaggerated, you should go visit my blog. I was already working at comics for years before I started working on Sandman. Sandman was something that, you know, was probably the thing that actually made me known as a comic artist, and I'm superbly grateful for that. Highly grateful to Neil and to the characters. I loved Sandman as a comic. I was working on Wonder Woman at the time for DC Comics. I had already painted a classics illustrated of the Scarlet Letter that Craig Russell adapted. I had worked for smaller companies for, oh gosh, 4 or 5 years at that point. And I had been asked at San Diego Comic Convention by Kim Metzger. Kim, you like when I mention you. I used to try and not talk about your pervy drawings that you like. Asked me to draw a sketch of Death, the character, in the nude.
Ah.
Well, actually, he said naked. He was very nervous about asking me, would I mind drawing this character naked? And having...
Was it a coy pose that...
It was a coy pose, because I said, well, I spent years doing life drawing in school, and there was... I found nothing erotic about it in any way. So I thought, well, I think this guy wants a drawing out of me that's going to be a bit provocative. Mm. And maybe he wants me to draw it, because maybe something like that is all wrapped up in it. I don't know. Yeah. You know, it's like the girl drew me a naked picture. But I never mentioned his name about it. He got really mad at me. Mm. Came up to me at a convention and said, you know, you can mention my name about that, Jill, you know. And I went, okay, Kim, I'll say it was you and your new, because he's got a gajillion weird drawings. So I drew a cute picture of her on a tombstone, and she was kind of like turned sideways and doing something where you really didn't see anything. Maybe you saw a nipple or something, but that was about it. But it was a really nice shaded sketch, and I think he had someone ink it. I don't know. But Neil was at the convention. It was San Diego Comic-Con, and he went over and showed Neil the drawing. I was mortified. I was like, oh my God. You know, like, so when I met Neil, I didn't realize that until someone said, oh, you know, maybe it was Karen Berger. Jill, you have to meet Neil Gaiman. He's here. He draws, you know, this is Jill Thompson. She draws Wonder Woman. And here's Neil Gaiman. He's the writer of Sandman. I was like, oh my gosh, I'm so really excited to meet him. And he was like, oh, Jill Thompson. I just saw the most lovely drawing of Death you did. She was nude. She was naked. And I was like, I think I started, like, broke out into a sweat and turned red. And I was like, oh, my God. I was like, I'm so sorry you saw that. And I don't think... Neil says that he liked that drawing and, you know, then he wanted me to draw a brief life storyline. But I've heard from other people in the DC office that he had liked my drawing the first time, saw that drawing... And he was like, oh, what a cute drawing of Death. And I had something to do with it. But if me drawing Death naked got me that job, boy, am I happy that Kim Metzger got a $10 drawing at that time.
I mean, because that was how I first came across your work in Sandman and, you know, and loved it immediately. And so if Wonder Woman came first, don't take this the wrong way, but I can't imagine you drawing a superhero comic, because your work seems so idiosyncratic and suited to a kind of storytelling that has a multiplicity of voices and a depth to it that maybe traditional superhero comics, particularly Wonder Woman, who always seems to have been quite badly served by writers, wouldn't possibly allow your talent to shine.
Wow, thank you.
That'll be £5, please.
Puffed up. I'd never read Wonder Woman when I was a girl. I was a Marvel gal. I was the dork in Catholic school that liked superhero comics, Dungeons and Dragons, you know, The Hobbit, Renaissance fairs, and all that kind of thing. And of course, I love superheroes. I mean, who doesn't love powers? You wish you could fly. Yeah. I want to read people's minds, but not with all the terrible reading everyone's minds uncontrollably. I want to be Professor X, right? Phoenix, you know, things like that. Wonder Woman was always really boring to me because she was really perfect. And I like my Greek mythology flawed with some kind of a quest involved. But you want to draw comics and someone tells you that they're looking for an artist to draw Wonder Woman, you draw sample pages.
Yeah.
And I wanted to do my best because I thought she's a beautiful character. I would love to be able to work on something like this. When I got the call from Karen Berger, that, you know, would you like to do this book? The answer, of course, was yes. And I look back now and think, how was I able to manage 19 panels on a page that George Perez had written at one point? Because George writes very easy for him to do. But I did it. I pulled it off. And I love the work that I did on Wonder Woman at the time. And I would go back to her. I have a proposal for a graphic novel on everyone's desk right now at DC. Because I can always find something... that interests me about the character or about a character or storyline to draw. When I take a job, if it doesn't suit me, I wouldn't want to do it at all. But yeah, it's probably not my strongest suit, hitting a guy in the face with a car. Or, you know, I mean, I do like action. I do like superhero comics, but I find that I like quiet scenes much better. I like to draw characters. I like to bring animation to things that aren't necessarily animated sequences. I like the storytelling part of it. One of my favorite things I ever did, which I still consider a superhero comic, is The Badger with Mike Baron. To draw multiple personality, to make you see that drawing as eight different people. One of my favorite pages is The Badger and Max, his really fancy, kind of effete feminine character, arguing with each other in his hospital bedroom where the Badger's like aggressive and crazy and like talking about the situation they're in, and he slicks his hair back in the next scene and his face takes on a different character and he's talking to himself about the situation and he's calming the Badger down. And I thought, if I can pull this off, it's one of the my favorite things I've ever done. And I look at that and I think they're completely different people even though their faces are the same. While I was working on Wonder Woman at the time, my editor was Dan Thorsland, and he was the one, I guess, Neil had been calling for a while, talking about the Brief Lives storyline, and I was under an exclusive contract at the time to DCU, and they wanted me to finish my issue commitment to Wonder Woman before I could even be spoken to. So I had no idea that he was actually asking after me for quite a few months, and then I got a change of editors. I had been working with Tom Pyer, then Dan Thorsland came on, and Dan, I think he said it in a really nice way too. He was like, you know, I like working with you, Jill. I'm Wonder Woman. I like this and everything. He goes, you shouldn't be drawing this book. He goes, you know, Neil Gaiman's been calling about you drawing Sandman all the time, and that's a book you should be drawing. So I felt he was really doing his job editorially. And he goes, I'm going to talk to people downstairs and see if we can't slide you sideways. He goes, you're still working for the company. Why can't you finish your exclusive agreement in the last three issues or something by working on the comic you really should be working on? This would be really good for you. It's well suited to the way that your strengths seem to come out.
Presumably when you did Wonder Woman, it was part of that whole kind of chopping up of a comic into different people. So you have a penciler, an inker, colorist. Well, something like Sandman, then progressing on to Godmother et al., it lets you be more of a holistic illustrator, bringing your sort of painterly and, you know, sort of illustrative qualities to the fore.
Well, it was pushing me on my way. I mean, when I was younger, I thought what I wanted to do was draw comics. And to me, draw comics meant I wanted to be a penciler like John Byrne. If I could draw the X-Men and Terry Austin could have inked me, I would have been super happy. Actually, Terry Austin did ink a pinup of mine when I was about 19 years old for Johnny Quest for Kamiko. So
cool.
I did, you know, tick one of my life's goals off really early. But then as I continued to like draw comics and learn to express myself in that medium, I was less and less satisfied not finishing the jobs in my head, you know, just doing the penciling. To me, that was like, okay, now it's finished. Everyone should get to see it. And then it went to an inker. And then now you're collaborating. And, well, Vince Locke is an amazing artist and a fantastic watercolor painter. He also should always have been illustrating all of his own work. I should have been illustrating all my own work. We did a pretty good job together. And we have the same type of, you know, we certainly could talk the same watercolor language. But, you know, we both, I think, have done much better when we started moving along. It's like I have to be a cartoonist. I mean, but I want to be a cartoonist the same way Frank Miller is a cartoonist. You know, I'm creating things that are all my own. I don't want to just be part. I mean, I like collaborating with people, writers and everything, but I got too much going on that I want to get out, and it's hard for me to try and describe it to someone else, like how to get the end product of it, what's in my head. Now you have to finish my thought, so. Some people can do it. I think my husband and Eduardo Risso are doing a great job finishing each other's sentences with 100 bullets. So much so that, when Brian tells me an idea that he's got, I can't see anybody else but Eduardo drawing it, really. The first thing that pops into my head is how Eduardo would handle it, no matter what it might be.
Although, obviously, that depends on the project, because I was actually going to say to you, if you could pass on my regards to Brian, I really enjoyed Dr. 13, you know.
That's true. So, I mean, there are certain slots, but when Brian says, oh, I have a great idea for, you know, some of the next things he's going to do, turns out that now he will do them all with Eduardo because he mentioned them to Eduardo and wanted to see which one he wanted to do, and Eduardo said all of them. So now, I mean, I couldn't even think of, you know, him going off into a science fiction direction or a, I forget which other ways. He's got four awesome things. But now they do all, I'm starting to see landscapes and towns and cities and things that I don't even know what they're going to look like, but I'm seeing them based on all the work in 100 Bullets.
I mean, obviously you're aware of your peers and colleagues in the comic book industry, but as you sort of started your career, what were your influences as an illustrator? I mean, on a personal level, I mean, I'm seeing the likes of Edmund Gorey, perhaps some shoujo manga, you know, etc.
I was kind of lucky. I did have some manga influence early on, but that's because I was the one girl at the comic book store, and they had a dirty cardboard box filled with foreign comics, which included my 2000 ADs and a few, you know, Akiras and some other, you know, kind of weird Japanese robot magazines that would have comics and things in them. You couldn't read them. You didn't know what they were all about, but you did get to see them. And I hung around with the older crowd, and we went to science fiction conventions. There was always the animation room where they were playing, you know, like Galaxy 999 and Speed Racer and things that I, you know, it wasn't necessarily comics, but I did, you know, look at those cartoons. Those are awesome. but I've always been influenced by fantasy and science fiction, Peanuts. But I got drawn into comics pretty early. John Buscema, one of my favorite artists of all time, wasn't influenced by Kirby until I was an adult. I didn't like Kirby. It was ugly to me when I was younger. I liked something that looked more natural. Archie comics were really the thing that got me wanting to draw comic books. So in Magic Trixie, you probably see a lot of Bob Balling and Bob Montana and Little Archie, because Little Archies were some of my favorite stories. If I could get all the Little Archie comics that I would read over and over and over again with my brother, we would eat lunch. We would come home from school, eat lunch, and go drag out the box of comics, Archie comics, and pull out the ones that were on the bottom because you hadn't read those in a while. You put the one you read on the top and go reach down to the bottom. One day I happened to pull one out, and it was a Scary comic, which was a Marvel comic. I don't know how it got in there. My father would bring comics home for me that I liked, and I think when I had gotten all the Archies that there were available on the turnstile, he just grabbed something else. But I looked at it, and everyone was like, and killing each other, and there were, you know, maybe it was, you know, had some scare Mephisto or somebody scary on there, and it was like, put it away, until suddenly I went, that looks pretty cool. And then, you know, like, opened it right up to, I was some middle of some X-Men drama, you know, with Byrne Claremont, and like, kind of changed my comic book life, and then I found a comic book store. In school, I learned a little bit about art, you know, so I kind of watched painting shows on public television. Tried to copy that, was not good at it. It wasn't until I went to art school I picked up a brush to do watercolor, and my instructor said, you know, he told us we would never get it right the first time, that he personally was going to come up and rip up three or four of our still lifes before we would get it right.
And that's an incentive.
It was a really good incentive. It was to teach us that if you wanted a job in illustration or advertising, you can't get wed to what you're doing, because it's not about the art, it's about the client. And they can come in at 5 minutes till five on a Friday and say, oh, we changed our mind, we want all this to be purple now. And you can't go, but I spent all week doing this. It's crap.
Yeah.
And you have to start over. So I was really worried, because I was done with my still life quickly. And whenever he would come by, he would walk, we had these big rows, long rows of desks with still lifes in front of them, and he would come walk behind you, and if you heard him stop, it meant you were screwed. So he stopped behind me, and I would just keep going into the dark area, thinking, because if he thinks I'm finished, he's going to tear it up. And finally, he saw, you know, I would sweat when he would come behind me. I would, like, get all red-faced and be like, oh no. And he stopped, and he bent down next to my ear, and he said, you can put down the brush, Miss Thompson. You've got it.
Oh, cool.
And I waited to hear him walk away. I still expected him to come back and tear it up, because he was kind of that kind of a guy. And he went away and he didn't come back. And because I liked what it looked like, and I went, this is easy. You know, in my head I thought, this is easy. Everyone's like agonizing over it, but I can't do opaque at all. It takes too long, and I'm a really impatient person. I like to get it done. If I can't make it look like it looks like in my head the first time, then I got to do something else. And I've abandoned things that I'm doing. It's like, I won't try and rework the same composition. I've torn up pages of Magic Trixie while I'm working on this, because I can't make one thing work. And I went, well, I guess this doesn't work. Toss it in the recycling. Only to have Brian come in, are you throwing this page away? Why don't you just finish it? It's like, it's wrong. have to turn away. He goes, you're almost done. It's like, nope, I kept screwing it up. He goes, ugh, and walks away.
Does he keep it for a special file?
No, I think he takes it out to the recycling bin.
As you were saying, that sort of different clients have different requirements of you as an artist. In a way, it does feel like there are a variety of different Jill Thompsons. There's the one who, as you were saying, Peanuts is an influence. So those sort of manga-style volumes that you've done, like The Dead Boy Detectives and At Death's Door, are in a more sort of cartoony style, which maybe suits that sort of storytelling. And then other things, like your more personal projects, such as Magic Trick Scene, Scary Godmother, are in a more sort of illustrative style.
More cartoony.
Well, I suppose, but the way that they're sort of hand-watercoloured makes them look more like children's books rather than sort of manga. So
those were also big influences for me, children's books. I mean, I still haven't done a proper... Well, I guess Little Endless Storybook is the closest thing to a children's book I've ever done, because words are on one page, illustrations are on the other. But I loved Bread and Jam for Francis. Some of my favourite books. I give them... I have 8 nieces now, and now I get to buy them all over for Isla, because I got them for all the other girls. And I like to read them out loud. I love reading stories. So, and I like doing all the voices. So, Holly Hobby's work, Toot and Puddle. I have lots and lots of children's books. I still will buy children's books before I'll buy an art book, because I love the illustrations. And I feel, you know, I'm an illustrator. These are my peers. I have to see things that I personally can't do, or things that I probably could do if it's, you know, similar enough. But why didn't I think to do like that? Because I always go back to what's the easiest for me. Mm. It's like I haven't challenged myself with a new medium. Like, I think I should do one in cut paper. Then I look at all the other people's cut paper books. No, they do a really good job of it. I should just do a Jill Thompson book, because I should just be me. But I do like to do a lot of different types of styles every once in a while.
You sort of described yourself as a geek growing up, as the one girl who read comics. Mm-hmm. I mean, do you think that's perhaps one of the reasons why there aren't so many women in the industry at the moment? Because when, you know, a decade ago, if you were a woman who enjoyed comics, you were sort of like in the minority. Well, now it's quite acceptable for girls to like comics, particularly with the growth of manga. So maybe in another decade's time, there'll be loads of women working in the industry. But at the moment, it's sort of a jet lag in a way.
I think it depends on where you grew up.
Right.
Because obviously in Japan, there were always comics for women. And in France, I've always found when I would go to Fnac or something, you would see mothers, kids, grandparents, all kind of standing in their section of the graphic album area, finding something that was kind of well-suited to them. There were different genres. So you'd go to the genre you enjoyed. This was the form of storytelling that this story was told in. It wasn't that, you know, they have with the bande dessinée for children, which are the ones I buy when I'm there, because that's about the extent of my high school French. So I feel really proud of myself that I can actually read it. I'm trying to think some other places. There were plenty of comics that were kind of for everybody, you know, in Geekland. You know, like, if science fiction is some of the headiest, most complex thoughts that we've got out there. I mean, the fact that a lot of the things that were only dreamed about in science fiction books are actually gadgets we now use every day. Means all of their grand imaginings actually worked on one level or another. So to be told that you shouldn't waste your time reading that kind of stuff, I would always be a great defender of that. I remember when I was just starting to work in comics and I was on a news program in Chicago, and the woman asked me, she was like, I used to read this stuff when I was a kid and then I kind of stopped. And she goes, you know, why do you, you know, why is this a good job? Why are you doing this? And I said, well, you know, I can't answer that question the way you've asked it, because I never stopped reading it. What made you fall away from it? It's like, I found material that interested me as I grew up. But at some point, and I was interested in boys and, you know, all the other things that she said took her attention away from it. I just had a little extra place for the thing that I still liked. But it wasn't the only thing I liked. I like alternative lands. I like plays. I like set design. I like fantasy worlds. If it's film or whatever, it's like I like to escape to different places. Whether or not it's a comic or some other medium is, you know, neither here nor there, I guess. So I think at the time, there were not a lot of comics being written by and for women. But I think enough of us that enjoyed the material that was out there started wanting to express ourselves in this way,
yeah.
which now suddenly makes there a lot more material out there that might appeal to a broader audience, including, you know, I always wanted to write, you know, Magic Trixie and Scary Godmother was, my grand design was to create something I liked, but also something that would get all my girlfriends who'd had babies into reading comics. Because they would always say, I don't know how to read it. And the bubbles are, what do you call those things? Mm. Word balloons. Well, yeah, the talk thingies, bubble thingies, they, I don't know how to read them.
Mm.
I said, well, in this country, you read from left to right, top to bottom, the same you do with a printed word. Mm. And the pictures are there to help move you from the top to bottom, I guess. So when with Scary Godmother, when I started out, I would just put regular typeface as instead of a caption box. And I had a lot of my friends, she'd go, I don't like comics, but I like yours.
Mm.
And I said, is it just the fact that there's type on the page is getting them into it? Well, good for me.
Yeah. Well, no, I mean, I've heard Brian Talbot say much the same thing, that when he did Tale of One Bad Rat, he was aware that there were people who were put off by the language of comics. And so when he drew that, he tried to imagine it for someone who's reading a comic for the first time and make it as easy a read as possible.
Which but is why I try and use the least amount of captions or superfluous dialogue. I mean, I can talk for 15 hours straight, and I probably could write my characters talking the same way, but I feel like it's not necessary. And my favorite comics have always been a really good combination of dialogue and pictures.
Mm.
And if I can tell something almost completely silently, and I'm going to do it because I feel it's serving the medium the best way possible. And maybe that's what helps those who have a bit of difficulty starting out reading comics get into them. And I wouldn't mind being a gateway drug for comic books.
Yeah, definitely.
That'd be fine for me.
Cool. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
There are various children's books by Jill available now in all good bookshops, such as Magic Trixie, Scary Godmother, and their sequels, while the new comic book series, Beasts of Burden, created by the artist with writer Evan Dorkin, starts next month, with the first installment that we discussed earlier available for download for free online. For links about all these, please visit our blog at www.panelborders.wordpress.com. Segueing nicely from this installment into the next, September brings a quartet of shows exclusively about women who work in comics, starting with my interview with Francesca Cassavetti, who Richie Chandler mentioned on last week's show, and Dickon Harris's interview with the elusive Miss B. And that'll be broadcast on Resonance FM on Thursday the 3rd of September 2009 at 5 p.m, with the podcast available to download soon after. Thanks for listening.